Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everyone, welcome. This is Rare Bird Radio. My name is Tyson Cornell. I'm on the line with a very important author guest that we have today. We're on here for a few reasons. One, we're going to talk about the book, and then we're going to talk about a pretty exciting show that we have going on in Los Angeles this Thursday night, March 24th at 8 p.m. The author is Paul Myers. The book is A Wizard, A True Star, Todd Rundgren in the Studio, which came out in November from Jawbone Press. Now, this book is, I don't know exactly what number it is, but it's a series of books that follow the music industry and kind of take a different, I wouldn't say obsessive slant into things, but a really hard-driven look at a particular aspect of a musician's life. Such as this, which focuses on Todd in the studio. So, Paul, are you there?
Hey, hi. How you doing, man?
Oh, thanks for coming on. So this book is out, and it's getting a lot of really great press. I've heard a lot about it, and you and I did speak briefly about it a couple years ago. So this has been in the pipeline for a while. And obviously, from reading the book, you're Todd obsessed, which is cool.
Well,
How did you get into this? I mean, can you give us a little bit of a backstory?
Yeah, I'm going to give you the classic nerd qualification here and say that I don't like to think of myself as obsessed, but I'm a completist. I'm a musician and producer, and over the years I've become a writer. And so what I often do is I often choose subjects that I know that I'll have a lot to talk about. And over the years, I've written assigned works where like a publisher has asked me to write about like the history of the British blues, and that became the book before this called It Ain't Easy, which was really about the British blues in the 50s. And those were great because I was interested, you know, having grown up with some of the rock bands that were inspired by the British blues, so I knew I could bring something to it. But this one I said to myself, okay, I want to find a publisher, and I had to go all the way to Britain to find it, who would be interested in something very specific, which is taking a look at Todd Rundgren as a producer of his own work. Don't get me wrong, I love his solo records and everything, but he also produced like XTC's Skylarking, which is one of my favorite albums of all time.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, if you dig deeper, he produced the New York Dolls debut album in 1973, and he produced Grand Funk's We're an American Band, and he produced Patti Smith's Wave album, her final Patti Smith group album. And you start to see, and then he worked on The Band's, one of his first records, he was an engineer on the group, The Band, on Stage Fright, and he worked on Sparks' debut, like he produced Sparks' debut album, and you start to think, oh my God, this guy pops up everywhere. So just to wrap up what I'm saying here, I basically said to the publishers, can I write a book where I talk to Todd Rundgren, more or less chronologically, about everything he's ever produced, then I will go and talk to every one of the artists he produced, and then I'll match up the stories. And it'll become narrative. It's kind of like weird because people ask me, is this a biography of Todd Rundgren? And I say it's an accidental biography of Todd Rundgren in that I'm not necessarily concerned with every meal he ever had or every relationship he ever had, who he might have been the father of or not. What I'm concerned about is how he worked in the studio. But what emerges is who he is as a person. And that's why I'm really happy with it. I actually, without being arrogant, I don't think there's a lot of books like this. And I feel like it's an area that I'd like to pursue more, and I have a few plans in the future, which I will get into at some other time.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting angle. I mean, it's like, you know, when I think of Todd Rundgren, I think of a very, I don't know, it's in the book, he's like, I forget who said it, but you can remind me, he's a control freak. Was it Bad Religion? And he's like,
Greg Gaffin, Bad Religion.
Exactly. I mean, if you want a producer that's going to come in here and go, oh, it sounds great, man, and, you know, and then 6 months later, you hear things that are out of tune, and you're like, dude, you know, why didn't you just tell me, you know, when that was going on? And they're like, oh, I heard that, but I just didn't think of speaking up about it. He's not that kind of guy.
No, and there's a really, an even more accurate quote is Lenny Kaye of the Patti Smith Group says in the book, if you know what you want, that Todd told him this. Todd Rundgren told Lenny Kaye of the Patti Smith Group, if you know what you want, I can go get it for you.
Yes.
If you don't know what you want, I can do it for you.
There you go.
And that's what makes Todd unique in that, I mean, as good as Phil Spector was as a producer and, you know, and songwriter, I don't know how, if he could play every instrument in the studio the way Todd could. And I'm not saying that I'm not going to get into the relative merits of who is a more influential producer. And George Martin couldn't rock out the way the Beatles could, but he could arrange the strings. It's like, so quite often the skill set of the producer is almost the opposite of the artist. In this case, Todd is the kind of guy, because he's a rock guy, he would get in with a rock artist and he would pretty much know how to play everything of their own.
Yeah.
He even plays the drums somewhat well. Like, and,
uh-huh.
And of course, he's an amazing vocal arranger and can, if needed to, sing all multi-part harmonies on tape, you know.
Yeah.
And the only problem comes, like you just alluded to, he's very sure of himself, or he has been over the years. And when he was riding high, people would hire him to be that guy who would know what to do. So
mm-hmm.
he would take that to heart, and he would be very strict with people. And sometimes people got really upset with him, you know, and there's
yeah.
definitely a legacy, a lineage of that sort of thing, you know.
Well, do you think, he's looked at as a hit maker in a lot of ways, and especially someone that has street credential and is admired by critics as well. But, I mean, it's like, do you think it's the same type of thing where people are having trouble with something, so they bring in Papa Rubes and he makes it happen? Is Todd that kind of producer?
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's certainly in his heyday. I mean, he's been distracted over the last maybe 10 years, and he produces very few albums now for other people. But when he has done productions, when he was riding high, let's say the 70s through the 80s, he was the kind of guy who, yeah, like XTC. XTC didn't pick him. They picked him from a list that the record company was forcing on them because they needed to commercially validate the amount of investment that Virgin Records had put in them. And
yeah.
so they were kind of shotgun married to Todd Rundgren based on the fact that one of the guys in XTC was a huge Todd fan and said, if we're going to have to take an American producer who's going to, you know, hold us, it might as well be Todd Rundgren. And
yeah.
and it really rankled Andy Partridge, most famously of XTC. And Andy Partridge, to this day, on any given day, he'll say he either praises Todd's work on the record but couldn't stand the man, or he'll even dismiss the work because he'll be in a mood about Todd. So, and, you know, Todd's the same. Todd doesn't suffer. He says he doesn't care what people say about him, and I've never, ever seen him actually care about what people said about him. Like, he doesn't show that to the public anyway. He doesn't show it to me.
Yeah.
As close as I got, I don't think I ever saw the, like, whatever guard he would ever let down. That's probably just something for his family, you know. Like, he's always pretty straight about not caring about what people say about him.
Well, you know, I think
Which
to do
course.
What he does, you need discipline probably has a lot to do with
yeah.
it. So.
He's a hard worker.
Yeah, a great work ethic. I mean, you bring up the XTC record, and what you say in the book about it is that, you know, Todd is essentially like a career saver, or at least Dear God was as a single. I love that song. I think it's great. I think it stands up. Every time I listen to it, you know, I love the kids singing in it, but I know that it's a conscious choice that they left in some off-key singing from that kid. And I thought that was so amazing for, you know, a top 40 song.
Yeah, and it's a gamble if you think about it, you know. And I guess what they did was they really wanted it to sound like a kid, you know. And
yeah.
quite often, you know, the history of using children in music and cartoons is they're usually voiced by adults. A boy being voiced by a female woman, you know, but a grown woman, and someone like, you know, a high pitched voice like on The Simpsons. And in this case, they got a very young girl. I think it was younger, Amber Vallette, I think her name was.
Uh-huh.
And I think she was a friend of a friend. And yeah, and I guess they may have even told her to sing a little flatter. They were going for that sound. They were going for that thing. I've heard various reports. I didn't put that in the book because I couldn't verify. The story became kind of a hearsay around the story is that
yeah.
they told her to sing it off key. Like, she came in and had pretty good pitch, maybe no vibrato, but. But anyway, I don't want to haggle about that. But, you know, but here you go. You got this great story about XTC. I could have written an entire book about that. But then mm-hmm. he also made, like, one of the most commercial top-selling albums of the 70s, Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell. And not only did he produce that record, he basically, again, saved that record because they couldn't get it paid for by any major label. So Todd said, why don't we front the studio costs because we got all these musicians here. Let's try and finish the record. And because he basically didn't bail on the record got made, and they brought in all these guys and, you know, Ellen Foley to sing. And then when it finally did sell, it was like a huge record.
Yeah.
And Todd became a millionaire for a very short period of time because he sank all his money back into like video gear and other projects, computer things, and you know he's done a lot of great things with the money. But I think that you know other people would have just kept a few million, you know.
Well, I like that. He's a man that puts his money where his mouth is in a lot of ways. So. Which doesn't really fly a lot of time. The golden rule: don't invest your own money. But
this gets back to what I was saying about him not caring about what people think about him. Like, I have an opinion about Todd. I don't think he's always the. I don't think his people skills were always the sharpest. But he was very generous to me. He was always very polite, and he's got a great sense of humor. And why I wanted to clarify saying that I'm obsessed with Todd. I'm not taking it too personally, but I was not obsessed like a fanboy obsessed. I was kind of obsessed with his body of work. But I wanted to get to know the man. I wanted to know is he as much of a brusque figure as everyone says he is. And I can understand from the anecdotal evidence that he was, and he even says so. Like he even said that when he did the record with the band, Levon Helm wanted to kill him. Levon Helm wanted to kill him. And Robbie Robertson said, yeah, that's true. That's true. Levon wanted to kill him. And then I asked Todd about it, and Todd said, laughs. He said, yeah, I guess I was a bit of, you know, I was a bit of a cocky kid. I probably deserved it. You know, and he understands. Like, you know, he knows. And he kind of laughed, though, because it's funny that people remember this stuff, you know. For him, it was another month of his life, you know.
Oh, yeah, totally. And, what was an average year? What is an average year for Todd? Like, 1975. I mean, what was he... How many records did he do?
73, 74, 75, and even 76. The guy was like going from album to album, then tour, then album, and then album. You know, like and what he was doing was by that point he created Utopia, which was a whole other band.
Mm-hmm.
So he would have a solo record on the go, a Utopia record on the go. So that's two album projects, and then he'd be producing somebody else. He'd be producing that period it would have been Grand Funk Railroad, and then you know, and then some bands that you didn't hear about, like, or he did Hall & Oates' the Hall & Oates album War Babies, which wasn't a very big commercial seller, but now Daryl Hall embraces as one of his more artistic records.
So he
would have gone from working on a spaced out prog rock record with Utopia, then doing War Babies with Daryl Hall and John Oates, and getting his Philly side on.
Yeah.
And then he'd go out and do a solo record and write an album like Faithful, where he's he's doing like six originals and then six covers of songs like The Beatles' Rain and Strawberry Fields Forever. The guy was just busy. And then, of course, playing dates in between then. And, you know, so he's making a lot of coin. And around that time is when he started working on Bat Out of Hell for Meatloaf, so he could afford to float the front costs when they couldn't get a record deal. Because he was making enough money that he was kind of a house producer, and then he built his own studios, and so the guy was just busy, you know, and working, and his instincts were firing pretty well in those days. You know, like he would more often than not get a fairly, you know, commercial result in the sense that it was something that people wanted to hear. You know, he worked with the Tubes around that time too. It's just incredible. Like so, yeah, he would, like I said, about six projects a year, maybe five. You know.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't keep that up. I mean, you couldn't keep that pace up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a lot of work. And, let me just say this. You probably don't know this. I'm a Yes fanatic.
There you go.
You know, I'm crazy about Yes. And since I was about 5 or 6 years old when my older brothers took me to see them play, I just, you know, and even to this day, I'm a nut. I have a Yes tattoo. What do you think, Todd? You know, I mean, with more influence, with somebody like Steve Howe, I mean, what kind of damage could they have done together? And if not, what kept them away?
Well, here's an interesting thing, as you may know from the book, is there was a period where I think when he was producing, when Todd was producing the the New York Dolls, and his then girlfriend Bebe Buell was like a total fixture in the New York club scene. They'd go out to see the New York Dolls, and it was all scrappy and just pre-punk glam rock, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Todd was giggling the whole time because, and then what Bebe says is that Todd was giggling because when he'd go home, he would listen to nothing but Yes records, you know.
I know that, yeah.
And so the Utopia records were a combination. The first Utopia records were super progressive with multiple time signatures and speedy parts, mm-hmm. And he was totally in thrall of two things at least. One was Mahavishnu Orchestra,
uh-huh.
It was Yes, and then maybe also Frank Zappa.
Mm-hmm.
So the original Utopia sound was, if not modeled on, it was definitely influenced by Yes.
Uh-huh.
Then you get to the point where by the time they're making the Raw album, which is 76, and it's the first time the four-piece band is together with Kaz Sultan on bass, who's an awesome
mm-hmm.
dude, for one thing. He's an awesome dude, but he's an awesome bass player. They recorded that in a barn in Woodstock. Part of it was recorded in Woodstock, New York, in a barn engineered by Eddie Offord.
Uh-huh.
Eddie Offord, you know, as a Yes fan, Eddie Offord produced a lot of the greatest Yes records from the,
mm-hmm.
the original days.
Absolutely.
And so that was definitely their the one time when I think they were literally going for what would Yes do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Todd being Todd, he will never ever say it in those terms, but you could tell that the band was definitely, you know, high and reverential towards Yes. And also, just one more thing, that period is also when he produced Steve Hillage's record.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Hillage, of course, had been in Gong, another progressive rock group from around the same time as Yes, a little more trippier. And Steve Hillage came to New York to play with Utopia because they also wanted to do something in a prog vein, but with
yeah.
maybe some mild commercial instincts, which is what Yes was. Yes was a
uh-huh.
progressive rock band that had almost Beatle-like sense of hooks, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
So that convergence is completely of a piece with what Todd is about, you know, or
mm-hmm.
was about. He changes all the time.
Yeah. Well, I had to bring that up. There's an obvious connection.
Yeah.
And I think a future venture will definitely have to be Yes Radio. But we have about 12 minutes left, so I want to make sure that we talk about the show that's happening.
Oh God, this Largo thing is so exciting. So Thursday, the 24th, that totally like at 8 o'clock, I've teamed up with Scott Miller, you might know, or some of your listeners might know. Scott Miller was a band called Game Theory in the 80s and 90s, and he was also in a band much more recently called Loud Family. I think they still play. And Loud Family is very cult and influential. Anyway, Scott has a blog called Music, What Happened? You know, music, colon, what happened? And he writes about the songs that are super influential for him. And he put together a book, a really great book of his blogs called Music, What Happened? Around the same time as my book, A Wizard of True Star, Todd Runger in the Studio, came out. And we both are San Francisco-based. So in November in San Francisco, we did a show where we teamed up and called it Wizards and Stars.
Mm-hmm.
So then
mm-hmm.
we had the bright idea. It worked so well using local musicians in San Francisco. So we said, let's take it down the road. Let's take it to Largo. Let's see if Largo will have us. And, of course, Flanny there is an awesome dude, and he said yes. So we booked it, and then we started getting all these L.A. people some of that we'd known for years and some that we just met recently. And so various people are volunteering to come and play a couple of Todd Rundgren covers
mm-hmm.
in honor of the book being about Todd Rundgren. So it's an amazing lineup.
Yeah,
so,
and I mean,
will I tell you?
Yeah, well, yeah, definitely tell us. But
okay,
first,
so,
I mean, we so, well, hold on. First, we want to, you know.
Question.
Oh yeah. Todd is not going to be here, right? I mean,
No, Todd
we can't
is not
totally confirm that Todd will show up.
No, we can't confirm that.
Yeah.
No,
okay.
I've invited him, and I'm in constant contact with Michelle Rundgren.
Yeah.
And she said, for one thing, this is great. They endorsed the book.
Uh-huh.
They haven't officially put it on a website or anything, but they're when they do live shows now, when Todd Rundgren plays the East Coast right now,
mm-hmm.
he's selling the book at merchandise tables. Which,
ooh.
Considering it's not, this is not like an authorized biography. This was a book
mm-hmm.
I wrote about him with his participation. But he must
well,
he must see it as an accurate record enough that so they're endorsing the book. So yeah, there's no word on whether they'll show up. I certainly would never ever promise that he's going to show up, but you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mentioned that right off the bat because I'm sure that's on people's minds. I mean, just one thing is, you know, when Todd is selling the book at shows, is he willing to sign these books? Because I know, yeah, like for instance, you know, I did this thing with Patti Smith. She would sign her stuff, but she wouldn't sign like the 33 and a third horses book because she didn't write it.
Right.
Do you know what he's signing?
Todd has signed. I have a people send me photographs now because I'm the Todd guy, right? Like I suddenly became the Todd guy, and so people will send me photographs of the inside page of their copy of my book, and it's signed by Todd. And I think because the book is about all of his work, he doesn't feel so bad signing it. And again, because he thinks the book, he has never actually said to me that he thinks the book's great, but he clearly has told people, you know, check this out. And he went on Jimmy Fallon and brought that book with him as something that, you know, he held up his own record and Jimmy Fallon held up my book and Todd applauded it on camera, which was such an awesome thing. So I feel like I've gotten as much endorsement as you can get from a guy like Todd who's, you know, he's not going to take out an ad on his own, you know what I mean? But so, yeah, that's great. So, but he knows about this gig. In fact, you know, some of his management have told me that they're based in L.A. and they definitely asked me if they can come. So they're all coming. And the question
cool.
is if Todd wants, maybe Todd doesn't want to show his face, like, because it would be too embarrassing because it's all in his honor and everything. I don't expect him to show. He doesn't go out for one thing. He doesn't really go out if he's not working.
Yeah, but he, you know, I mean, you know, he's not going to be in disguise in the back of the theater like Jim Carrey at whatever that awards show he was. He's not going to be the homeless guy.
Yeah, although I would love it if Todd showed up in a fake beard and or you know one of those Michael Jackson surgical masks or something. But I don't think it's going to happen. But
okay.
But
so who else is coming?
Somebody who played with him. Is now a big soundtrack producer and composer. Lyle Workman is coming down. Lyle actually is in the book. Lyle Workman used to be the guitar player in Todd's band in 1989 and 91, played on two of Todd's albums and tours. He also was in a band called Bourgeois Tag, which was one of Todd's sort of one-hit wonders. They were a great band, but they only had this one big hit called I Don't Mind at All, which... Lyle's going to come and play, and he said he's bringing a string quartet, which is like blowing my mind that he's bringing a string quartet. And Mike Viola of the Candy Butchers, and a lot of your listeners will know who he is anyway. Mike Viola is also now a big soundtrack guy, but he's also a power pop guy. And Mike Viola is going to come with Lyle, and they're going to do two songs. They're also going to do 1,000 Umbrellas by XTC, which is Skylarking, which Todd produced, right? So
yeah.
So personally, I would come from a long distance just to see those two guys. But we've also got the guys from Rooney. Taylor Locke I met at a Sloan show. Sloan's one of my favorite bands, and Taylor was opening for, with his own band, The Ruffs. He was opening for Sloan, and we got talking about Todd Rundgren, and I said, dude, if I ever come to L.A. with this book, would you like to come and play a song? Next thing you know, he's organized like a four-song set with all these Rooney guys and Taylor Locke and The Ruffs guys. And so they're going to play, and they're bringing in the Chapin Sisters.
Of course.
Chapin Sisters are going to play, and, you know, so you got, like, Ned and Louie from the Rooney and the Ruffs people, and you've got Chris Price, who was in a band called Price, but he's also in Taylor Locke and the Ruffs. And I'm bringing DJ Bonebreak from X, is a friend of my I have a band in San Francisco called the Paul and John. I'm the Paul, and John is coming down with me from San Francisco. And John's really good friends with DJ from X, and DJ is going to play with the Paul and John, along with a guy named Peter Gilstrap, who plays with Ben Vaughn a lot. And so we're going to have that happening. And then Scott Miller, of course, is going to play his own set of he's going to play a few selections from his book, and then he's going to join us to do Couldn't I Just Tell You by Todd Rundgren, which is also mentioned in his book. So it's like that's where we come together. We did this in San Francisco, and it was a hoot. So, there's enough people there. We're going to try and pack it in. And, of course, we've got Dave Foley from the Kids in the Hall, who's an old friend of mine. Dave Foley's a big music fan, and I told him, you know, do you want to come to this? And he said, well, do you want me to host? And I said, well, yeah, actually, I was going to ask, but I didn't know how. And he said, well, I'll totally do it. So we got Dave Foley hosting, so he's doing some stand-up these days, so hopefully he's going to tell us some jokes, or even just being there. I'll laugh just looking at him on stage because he's such a funny guy, you know. And,
the true comedians are.
That song. Yeah.
Yeah, who knows, man? You know, and that's what's beautiful about a place like Largo is that there are instruments all around. and anything can happen. Anybody can show up. So let me just reiterate the info for this. Thursday, March 24th, 8 p.m. at Largo at the Coronet Theater, 366 North La Cienega Boulevard, Los Angeles, California, 90048. Yeah, that was all from memory. You can go to largo-la.com for more info. Advanced tickets are on sale via laughstub.com. And we're looking forward to a fabulous show. So, we'll just continue the discussion after all this festivity.
I've been told to tell you that to tell everyone that because a lot of my friends are all walk up people, they're last minute people. Largo has only a couple hundred seats, so I don't want anyone to be let down. And I ordinarily don't tell people to buy advance tickets, but I think it's probably safer to buy advance tickets for this.
Yeah,
it's gonna be. I swear, there's gonna be some surprise guests that I can't tell you about the surprise guests because that was kind of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
But there's gonna be a few people that I haven't mentioned playing. They're like, and they're very put it this way, they're gonna sound great in Largo because I've seen these people in Largo before, and it just that's as much as I could say without spelling it out. And it's just gonna be so good, and I would pay to see this show. And like, I'm lucky that I get to be there for free, but. I I'm not saying that. I don't hype everything I do, but this is going to be quite an event.
And you're going to be there
signing books.
And so is
selling
Scott.
Books, signing books, yeah.
And books are going to be available for sale. You don't have to worry about rushing out to your Barnes & Noble, though you can do that and pick one up at the show. And for all of you independent booksellers out there, I don't want you to think that I was excluding you by mentioning a chain bookstore. So you can get it anywhere.
Paul,
looking forward to a fabulous. This is going to be great. We're going to have a wonderful time. So I'm going to outro with some tunes, and I would love to play something Todd-centric, but it's going to have to be a little bit of the Faces. So thanks, Paul, and we'll see you on Thursday.
Yeah, have a good time. Wizards and Stars.
Right, take care, man.
Bye.
You on a debris at the Sunday morning market. You were starting to the odds and ends. You was looking for a bargain. I heard your footsteps at the front door. And that old familiar love song. Gosh, you knew you'd find me waiting there at the top of the stairs. At the depot, with the General Workers Union, and yet that they'll never change a thing. Well, they won't fight, and they're not working.